Guys, we are going to get started in our series. It has a thesis attached to it. This is the thesis. If we know with greater clarity what happens when we die, the thesis is we're actually going to live our lives better. If we know how it ends, we're going to live our lives on this side of eternity better. That's the thesis. And so starting 4 weeks ago, we got stuck into this. And I still teach at the Graduate School of Business, so every now and again it leaks, and I have like graphs, because I love putting things in one page. That's kind of how my mind works. And so here's my graph. It's a little bit busy, but I'm going to try and explain to you what happens. On the left, we really have got two major buckets of where we came from, the question of origin. We either came here by chance, or there was a creator. Those are the two big buckets. Now, there's some arguments about how long it took and the methods, but basically two buckets. And then on the far side, what happens when we die, or the questions of destiny, there are a few forks in the road here. There's some saying, hey, we came by chance and we're going to disappear to nothing. There are others that said, no, there is a creator, but this creator loves us so much that we're just going to go straight into paradise as soon as we pass away. And then you'll see most faith systems in the world actually believe that there's going to be a judgment. There's going to be an assessment of how we stewarded our lives, and we'll be sort of filtered, if you were, into heaven, into hell, or into some cycle of reincarnation where we keep going until we've reached the state of nirvana or bliss, and then we enter into paradise. It's kind of all here in one diagram. And in the middle, you've kind of got the choices of, well, what's the meaning of life? What's the purpose? And how do I know what's right and wrong? Questions of morality, questions of truth. And so why I've put that up right at the beginning is just to help locate us and to realize you might not enjoy what we speak about today, but you have to find answers to these questions. There's no point deferring them. And in light of those, you make decisions about how you spend your life. There's a bit of a danger. There's been a bit of a shift. And it's well articulated by a Nobel Prize-winning poet who had heard of Marx's statements that religion is the opium of the masses. You know, it kind of dumbs you down in life so that you don't ask the bigger questions. And he said, no, there's a bigger danger. And I'll quote from him. He says, we are witnessing a transformation. This was written a few decades ago. A true opium of the people is the belief in nothingness after death. The huge solace, the huge comfort of thinking that for our betrayals, our greed, our cowardice, our murders, we are not going to be judged. And so today, as a sort of intro, we are actually going to be looking at this whole question of judgment. The whole question of judgment. Because if it's true that we came here by chance and we're going to nothing, then this isn't relevant at all. But if there is a creator, we could expect that that creator at the end is going to evaluate us according to the degree to which we were living in line of his design or not. Now, this is not a popular view to talk about judgment on a sort of Sunday night in Sea Point. The room kind of goes quiet. And isn't there also this verse? There seems to be, you know, even if you're back to church after a while, a whole verse comes to mind saying, didn't Jesus himself say, do not judge? So how does this whole thing play out? But straight away, there's a bit of an allergic reaction. So let's study what Jesus actually said in Matthew 7. Let's read it together. Jesus speaking, saying, judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Well, how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is a log in your own eye? Straight away, there's a bit of a compelling case. It's like, well, that Jesus said it. Paul, he said, judge not. Isn't Jesus teaching that this whole thing of judgment is a wrong turn in the journey of life? Well, I'd say let's lean a little bit closer. So I think what Jesus is actually saying is that each and every one of us has this tendency to see a fault in someone else's life far quicker than we ever see a fault in our own lives. That's what Jesus is addressing. Jesus doesn't have a problem with judgment. He's got a problem with people who judge everyone else before they do the work in their own hearts and in their own lives. Interestingly, if we study Jesus, he speaks about hell even more than he does about heaven. And he teaches about hell essentially being us insisting on our own way and saying, "I'm God, I'm not doing it your way. I'm going to do life my way." Placing ourselves at the center and insisting that everyone else complies with our wishes. Next week, we're going to delve into a particular teaching of Jesus. If you want to do some pre-work, you can read Luke 16. Think about a rugby team, and then this is the poor person that just wasn't in the team. Luke is his name, and he's number 16. And in Luke chapter 16, you'll see a rich man and Lazarus, Jesus' teaching on the disintegration of a life lived outside of God's will. But for tonight, maybe take this picture. It's always been quite helpful in my life. God should be at the center. Picture him as the sun, around which all the planets correctly orbit. And there's harmony and there's synchronicity, and that's life to the full. And then imagine us, instead of orbiting around God, insisting that, no, we should be at the center. And now everything else should orbit around us. That's at the heart of the rebellion that is spoken about in Scripture and that I can identify in my own heart. A sense in which, yeah, I could orbit around God, but I don't know if he's good. I don't know if he's trustworthy. I don't really believe that he has my best interest at heart. I'd rather place myself at the center and get everything to orbit around me. And so sin, if you picture it, is actually something quite static, where we go through life going, do this for me, do that for me, do this. And it involves energy, but essentially it places ourselves at the center, and we miss the mark when we do that. God made us as image bearers that are most alive when we place him first and orbit our lives around him, but yet we choose not to do that. Our poet picked up that there's a sort of contemporary tendency now to not even think of judgment or to think of God, whereas most cultures previously would have taught that there is a grain to the universe. There is a wisdom baked into life. And a life well lived is a life that finds out that wisdom and that truth and then orientates around it. So whether you look at Greek culture or even the Hebrews themselves and the wisdom of Proverbs, they would say, no. How you live a good life is you find out how it was made and what abundance looks like, and you change to fit in. But more and more today, we're taught to do the exact opposite. You're taught to find out about yourself. You're taught to that only you can do you, that if it's meant to be, it's up to me, to your own self be true. And essentially, you're taught to then give expression to that. And anything that clashes or connects in a different way to that is needs to be discarded and thrown off. That's the enemy. And how we arrived there, some writers had a compelling argument. They said, you know, we've made tremendous strides in science, and none of us want to go back, right? Tremendous strides in science, which have allowed us to change the physical world to suit our preferences. Thank goodness for fans, right? Aircons would be even better. Imagine, right? We changed the physical environment. That is fantastic, to suit our needs. But what's now happened is we've done the same in the metaphysical. We've said, hey, I want to change God to suit my soul needs. I want to change what's true or not to suit my identity and the full expression of it. I've seen us do it in the physical realm in science. Why can't I do that in a spiritual realm? The truth is that God has made us in his image, but lately we've preferred to make God in our image, and it's creating a lot of problems. And I just want to be sure that we're hearing Jesus correctly, because what Jesus is saying is the problem, Siri just started a new alarm for all of us, the problem Jesus is saying is that we have no longer orientated around God. We've tried to get the world to orientate ourselves. We've curved in on ourselves, as Steph said earlier. And that has led to a spiral that only he can save us from. And just to be clear, you get this. Jesus is teaching, don't judge. Because you're in the spiral, you're going to see everyone as not being right, not meeting your needs, and you're going to see all the little specks in their eyes when there's a log in your own. And Jesus is saying, deal with the log first. Deal with the fact that you're disconnected from me. That's the most important thing. He's not saying don't judge others. He's saying judge yourself first, and then you can get on with it. And if you want to believe me, have a look. Have a look from verse 5 onwards. Jesus speaking to us says, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. We're talking about judgment, and Jesus has just said in verse 1, don't judge. But now he's saying, you hypocrite. That sounds like quite a judgmental saying, right? He's going, hey, you say one thing, but you're doing something else. Jesus seems to be pretty clear on where life lies and where death lies. And in truth, he speaks to us and says, I want you to choose life. I want you to choose life. We're going to stick in Matthew 7. Let's just read. Jesus, who said, do not judge. Let's just have a look at how quick he is to say that there is life and there's death. Verse 11, he says, if you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who's in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Jesus is teaching on prayer, and he's basically saying, hey, you guys are parents, you care about your kids, and guess what? You're evil, and you still care about your kids. Imagine me, who's good. Imagine the Father. Imagine how good he's going to be. But let's not miss it. He's called them hypocrites, and a few verses later, he's saying, you're evil. You're missing it. You're selfish. You curved in on yourself, and even you care about your kids. Sounds quite judgmental. Let's keep reading. He now speaks about two paths, one that leads to destruction, one that leads to life. We're still in Matthew 7, by the way. Jesus, chapter verse 13 says, enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. There's a way of life. There's a way of destruction. This is Jesus. And who leads us on these two different paths? Who takes us there? Well, Jesus has got some strong words now for the false prophets, for the people who don't speak the truth. Let's read in verse 15. We just keep reading. He says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Every tree that does not bear fruit, good fruit, is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Maybe if you're leaning in for the first time, you maybe have had a view of Jesus being, okay, good teacher. He obviously told the crowds what they wanted to hear. Bit of a hippie, bit of a revolutionary, down with the man, power to the people. I can get why he'd get popular. But then you read something like this and you go, no wonder they killed him. No wonder they killed him. He wasn't a popular guy. He challenged people just as he is doing so tonight. Say, no. Your life should show the fruits of what you believe. If you follow in the narrow path and you walk in with me, you're going to walk in the good fruit. But if you don't, there's destruction ahead for you. We keep going. Verse 21, Jesus teaching, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Please notice the words, not everyone. Chilling words. This is a clear teaching of Jesus that there is some kind of filter that's going to get applied at the end of our lives. And it doesn't please me to say this. It doesn't make me jump up and down. My natural, raw emotional reaction is the same as yours. I go, oh, how is this going to work? That initial gut reaction. How is this working out, Jesus? We're dealing with weighty matters. But when we deal with weighty matters, we mustn't stick our heads in the sand and be like, oh, I don't like it. I'd rather make God up to be the way I'd like him to be. I suggest the exact opposite is what we need to do. We need to lean in and say, God, is there a bias here? Is there something I'm not seeing? Let's do that together tonight. And just to show you how weighty it is, let's just keep reading the last two verses. On that day, Jesus speaking, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then will I declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. It seems like Jesus is talking to people that used to come to church a lot. They prophesied. They did some demon stuff, mighty works in his name. And Jesus is saying, hey, man, don't think that attendance is what it's about. It's about transformation as you are reunited with me. So we're in danger, quite frankly, given our cultural bias, to not talk about something that Jesus talked quite a lot about in one chapter. A chapter that started with do not judge has got titles like, hey, you're evil. Hey, you're an hypocrite. Hey, don't go the wide path. It leads to destruction. There's a lot of stuff in here that, quite frankly, should make us lean in and say, we want to know more. Teach us, Jesus, about judgment. And so these three points will be quick. Don't worry. We need judgment. There is a problem with judgment. And finally, what does Jesus have to offer? My first point I want to make tonight is it's actually good news that there's judgment. I really believe that. There is good news. And one of the reasons why we don't think it's good news is a lot of us have been raised in the same sort of Western cultural figures and movies and songs and stories. And we think, oh, we're not so sure about judgment. But let me ask you this question. Are you offended by forgiveness? Are you offended by forgiveness? I don't think anyone here would go, yes, I'm offended by forgiveness. Most of us say, no, forgiveness is a great idea. God who loves everyone and forgives everyone, we're down with that. Please include me in that particular amnesty that gets granted, right? But let me tell you that if you hop to the East and you connect with many other cultures, this thing of forgiveness is a massive problem. How dare you forgive someone who's raped your daughter? How dare God be a God who just allows injustice to be perpetrated? They don't have a problem with judgment. They don't have a problem with justice. They've got a problem with forgiveness. How dare a good God allow people to just go do whatever they want with whoever they want? And so then my follow-up question is, okay, should our Western sensibilities trump those that come from other cultures? Is our culture superior to other cultures? So we say to them, hey guys, don't worry about forgiveness. You know, judgment's where the problem is. Or should we actually acknowledge, no, the cultures are probably not at a state where we could say we're superior, in which case we've got to then ask ourselves the question, maybe our bias is hiding a truth about who God is. Just conduct the following thought experiment, which I got from Pastor Tim Keller. He said, if there was a God who'd created all the diversity of what we see and celebrate, and yet every one of those cultures had curved in on themselves and had morphed God, then it should make sense that if God, truly God, arrived, every single culture at some point should be offended and at some point should be going, wait, this isn't how we would like to do it. And shouldn't it be a case that for us, that big one at the moment is judgment? We as a culture just go, we don't buy that, but forgiveness we're into. It's interesting that if you look at Christianity around the world, it is impacting cultures all over the world, but yet those cultures are not unchanged as they encounter. They come into the fullness of what God has for all of us. So just be aware that your Western cultural bias is at play, most likely. The second reason why we need judgment, besides having to deal with our blind spots as a culture, the second reason is we really suffer from injustice. We really do. A world where there isn't justice is a world none of us truly wants to be a part of. Is a quote here from Brian Tabb. He's writing about the States, but you can just replace streets of Minneapolis with streets of Cape Town, because I think it's the same for us. He says, justice is a matter of urgent concern in our nation. From the streets of Minneapolis to the halls of the Supreme Court, we long for a just world, yet live in a world marred by sin and its effects. We recognize the gap between how things are and how they ought to be. We may hope for systematic reforms, new laws, and better leaders and judges for the good of our society, but no legislation, election, or political appointment can satisfy the ache in our hearts for true righteousness and justice. We long for the judge of all the earth to do what is right. Which right at the end there is actually a quote from Genesis 18, Abraham describing his longing for a judge of all the earth who will do what is right. Truthfully, we know there is a gap between how things should be and how they are. And we long to fill that gap. And we try to plug in political systems. We try to plug in laws. We try to plug in the buzzer app, the ADT, whatever it is. We try our best. But deep down inside, we know there needs to be a more comprehensive solution. We need a justice that will sweep all injustice away. We know deep down inside that what would be good for us is a judge who's seen it all, done it all, who is good, who is wise, who is prudent, who's experienced, and who ultimately will make sure that everything that has been done, every injustice that's been perpetrated, will be judged and appropriately dealt with. We long for that in our souls. How long in a braai in South Africa before someone says, man, just one conviction for state capture, just one, just get someone, right? Something inside of us goes, it just hurts us as a nation the longer we allow injustice to be perpetrated. And of course, injustice that has gone on long before and will go long after. The final reason I think we need justice is we don't have a recourse to forgiveness. It is going to be an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, escalating violence back and forth. The only thing that actually truly stops the human heart is the story of forgiveness. And it, without a God of justice, it becomes impossible for us to really find the ability to forgive. Miroslav Volf, who was a Croatian theologian, he lived through the Balkan Wars and all the kind of violence that was done in Yugoslavia and Chechnya. He said the following. He said, if God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end to violence, that God would not be worthy of worship. The only means of prohibiting all recourse to violence by ourselves is to insist that violence is legitimate only when it comes from God. My thesis that the practice of nonviolence requires a belief in divine vengeance will be unpopular with many in the West, but it takes the quietness of a suburban home for the birth of a thesis that human nonviolence results from the belief in God's refusal to judge. In a sun-scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, it will invariably die with other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. What he's saying is, if you come to someone who's suffered massive injustice, is a victim of genocide, and you say, hey man, there's a God of love, love wins, just forgive your enemies, they're going to look at you with a blank stare saying, I need more than that. Otherwise, I'm going to pick up a weapon and go and get the vengeance that I feel is appropriate. But if you look at someone like that in the eyes and say, God has got this, God will judge perfectly and fairly, and that day is coming. You give someone the ability to say, thank you, there is a place I can go to with my injustice. There is going to be a reckoning for the people that have been involved, and therefore I have the ability to forgive. As I take myself out of the center and take myself off the throne of judgment and allow God to do that on my behalf. The obvious question of this Miroslav Volf quote is, okay, Paul, God might be the judge. It might be good that we're going to have a judgment, but then is he still loving? Is he still loving? This starts to now not sound like love. It's almost like if God becomes a judge, the love drains out of the equation and judgment kind of comes up. But God's character is consistent. He's the loving judge. And this is pointed out by Becky Pippert, who says, anger isn't the opposite of love. Hate is, and the final form of hate is indifference. God's love is not a cranky explosion, but his settled opposition to the cancer which is eating out the insides of the human race he loves with his whole being. A parent who loves their kids will stand in opposition to whatever addiction they're caught in, that cycle of diminishing pleasurable returns and a cycle of hopelessness and a cycle of diminishment. That parent will not go, well, I'm out. That parent will step in and do actively whatever it takes to free that child. A parent that loves their kid steps towards things that are going to harm their kid, not away. And so don't believe the lie that a God who's stepping towards us in truth is being unloving in doing so. No, he's looking to liberate, and it's because of his love that he is doing so. So we need judgment. We need judgment. As South Africans, we need justice. We need judgment. We cry out for it, but there is a massive problem, and this is my shortest point for tonight. And the problem is, where does that leave us? If there is to be a judgment, where does that leave us? Now, you might not believe in the Ten Commandments. You might not even know what they are, so let's park those for a moment. Let me just take your own cell phone, and every time you talk to someone and you say, hey, you should do this, or you must do that, I'm going to record it. And at the end of your life, we're just going to play your rules for living back to yourself. Let's see how you do, right? I don't know if you're anything like me. You're probably not even going to live up to your own standards of living. You're going to be that inconsistent. And so on a day where your record is shown, you're going to really be going, oh, please, 51%, 51%. That's all I need. That's all I want. But yet when you're measured by a perfect God, a holy God, you need 100%. And none of us are going to make it. And here's another danger. When we try and come to these questions, we all have enormous skin in the game. We're like a judge who's trying to judge a corporate case, and we've got like shares, our whole retirement savings in that company. And if we find them guilty, we lose all our retirement. And if we find them not guilty, you know, we're kind of like cheating a bit, but then it kind of helps us a bit. Can you see the analogy? We've got all our chips on this one. We have a lot to think about when it comes to what happens when we die, because we're all going to die. And we all want to know what that's going to be like. And it's comforting to kind of go, hey, there's no judgment, because then we think that's going to be better for us. But if it's not true, it's not helpful at all. So we have a problem, and the massive problem is ourselves. Daily Maverick, a guy quite honestly wrote this article, and he said, this is from the last week, he said, why add the horror of an eternal afterlife to the fearful life we're already living? And his kind of whole point was, man, we're already victims. Like, life sucks. It's hard. It's tough for South Africans. And now you want to add more trauma by making us think about, like, eternity afterwards. Like, just give me a break. We don't want there to be a judge, is kind of what he's saying. We don't want, like, some kind of reckoning. Life's tough enough already. And how should you live your life? This is how he ends it. He says, me, I say, sit back and enjoy your life. Forget immortality. You're only ever going to get this chance to live. We're subject to death, and therefore we're mortal, whether the atoms that make us do live forever or do not. That's where he's landed. He's just gone, life's tough enough already, man. I only get one life. Just don't think about anything. But he has the problem. Is he not in danger of that Polish poet's quote right at the beginning? This amazing opium of the masses, that nothing we do is ever going to matter. All our betrayals, all our murders, whatever, nothing ever matters. From dust to dust, we're just going to become earthworm compost. So they're not a danger. Firstly, that's not true. And that secondly, it's a denial of life that is truly life. We can't duck this. You might not like judgment, but then you've got to pick something else. There only are a few options, right? And so there is a problem with judgment. And finally, I'm gonna make the case that Jesus has something different to offer. He's firstly offering us the truth in love. He's not a populist I hope you've seen that already. He's telling people he loves the truth about what happens. And essentially, this is something he says in Matthew 10. He says, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Jesus used the word fear, which basically means give appropriate importance. Give appropriate attention to what happens when you die. The body is great. You must have cold swims. Thank God for Wim Hof and Tim Noakes and UTCT and all that cool things. It's of some importance we take care of our bodies. But let's not overdose on that when really our eternal souls are far more important and we understand what the resurrected body is able to achieve. And next week again, we are going to be talking more about what this looks like. But Jesus is quite clear that we need to pay attention to it. And John, writing in another book, makes very clear that it's Jesus himself who is going to be the judge. Let's read it, John 5 from verse 27. It says, he, which is God the Father, has given him, which is Jesus Christ, authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in tombs will hear his voice and come out. Those who've done good to the resurrection of life, and those who've done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Two paths, path of life and a path of judgment, but resurrection awaiting all of us. Jesus is quite clear. The truth is we need to give importance, attention to this. He himself is that judge. But that's not all he has to offer us. He has mercy. He has mercy to offer us. Jesus Christ, when he came, was man and God. He lived the perfect life so that when the scorecard came in, he's the only one who gets 100%. The only one. And he represents us before the Father. And whilst he's deserving of no guilty verdict, he is declared verdict. His verdict is declared guilty so that all of us can come in under his representation and say, we don't present to you our good works. We present to you Jesus Christ as our Savior. The Bible speaks about a cup that is not full of Satan's, you know, accusations. No, it's a cup full of God's wrath, of appropriate judgment to those who've rebelled. And it says, picture that cup going to the fullest brim. None of us could drink it and survive. Jesus Christ takes that cup and he drinks it and he drinks it, he drinks it right to the end and he declares, it is finished. I will take the judgment you and I deserved onto myself and I will represent you. And this is called mercy. Here is what it means. You don't get what you deserve. You don't get the wrath of God. It goes to him and not to you. earlier it said, those who do good. What does he mean by those who do good? Those that do good are the ones that stop curving in on themselves and they say, Jesus, I need you to be at the center. You take my judgment. The wrath of God goes onto you. I don't have what it takes. That's the good work you need to do. Surrender and say, Jesus, you have done what I couldn't do. Mercy is what he offers. You do not get what you deserve. And that would be good enough. Picture in my mind, I'm always like, that's like a clean slate. It's like you had a huge debt and now you're on zero. Like you haven't earned any money yet. Still some work to do, but thank goodness the debt's gone, right? And that's good enough. And now, God, I will spend the rest of my life just doing good deeds for you. That's not all Jesus offers. He doesn't just offer mercy. He offers this. He offers grace. He offers grace. Previously, he took a cup of wrath. Now he takes a cup and bread, and he calls his disciples closer, and he says, hey, I want you to do this in remembrance of me. I want you to host a table where all kinds of people can gather, rich, poor, old, young, English, Afrikaans, all 11 official languages. All of you are invited into my table of hospitality. And where previously I took the wrath of God, I now extend to you the hospitality of God. Where mercy was, you do not get what you deserve. Grace is, you get what you don't deserve. You get what you don't deserve. A cup overflowing in goodness and mercy. Streams of living water flow out of you as you're adopted into God's family. As you have an inheritance bigger and better than you've ever had before. We've spent 2 weeks looking at heaven and what that could look like. And it can start now already as you walk as a son and daughter of the God Most High. Jesus offers the truth and love, but then he offers himself. And he dies in his great mercy, but then he's resurrected to make it sure that we know that we know that we know that this grace is not a mirage that'll disappear when you get closer, but it's something that's been bought with his blood. And so his resurrection power is at work in all of us. Will you stand with me? I'm going to call the band up. We're going to have an opportunity to respond now. One of the ironies is that if you don't believe in judgment and you believe in a God of love, there's a tough question to answer. And that tough question is this: what did it cost you for your God to love you? What did it cost you? And you'd say, well, it didn't really cost me anything. He just has always loved. The wonderful thing about knowing that there is no injustice that'll be passed over, every single injustice will be dealt with. One of the most incredible things we know then is that God's love for us extended to the fact that not only is he going to be the judge, but he's stepped in as a savior. What did it cost Jesus Christ to love us? It cost him everything. It was his body broken for us, his blood shed for us.